Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Item 13, an African food podcast, and I'm your host, Yom Akuaku. Every week, we'll delve into the delicious world of African food, including chefs, curators, and bloggers. Here's the show.
Welcome to another show of Item 13. I have another Selassie in the chair with me today. We have Selassie Doche, who was born in Accra, Ghana. For those, but if you've been listening to this show forever, you should know where Accra is by now. Accra in Ghana, but was raised in the American South. Food has always been a large part of her life, and for the last several years, she's worked at several well-known fine dining restaurants in the Bay Area. She currently works as the chef de cuisine at High Felicia in downtown Oakland, California. Welcome to the show, Selassie.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I'm excited. Like I was telling you off air, you're the second Selassie I'm talking to today. So it's like a Ghana girl reunion in some ways. Thank you for joining us today. I think we're going to be delving into some really important topics here. But I always like to start with like your personal story, how your family ended up in the U.S., growing up in the South, if you have some color to add to that, and then just how you ended up in food.
Yeah. So I was born in Accra. My dad is a chemist, an organic chemist.
Okay.
Yeah. And my mom is a nurse. So when I was born, my dad was actually, I think, living in either the UK or in Canada. So when I was about like one, we left, me and my mom, we left Ghana to join my dad in Vancouver. So that was our first trip.
Yeah.
Lived in Vancouver till I was about three. Then we moved to Georgia, Atlanta, because my dad received a position at Georgia Tech, and he was going to get his, he was going to get his PhD there. So that's how we ended up in the States. My dad graduated and got his PhD whilst my mom was working at Grady Hospital, which is a very well-known hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. So just after about 10 years, we moved to North Carolina. That's where I went to like middle school, high school, like, so that was most of my formative years. That's how I really got more into like cooking more, because like I was always in the kitchen with my mom, always helping her, like cutting onions or peeling garlic or sorting through spinach to make spinach stew. And, I always took like a lot of like math and science in high school, because having parents from Ghana, they wanted me to either be the top three of a lawyer, doctor, or an engineer. but I wasn't really interested. So I took like some food classes actually in high school. There's a like a basic like food class. So I was like, well, I cook at home. This sounds cool. I'm taking as many, you know, honors and AP classes as I can, but I still want to have fun. So I took this class called Foods as an elective, like I want to say like junior year. Then I took it again senior year. And then I was like, all right, food is kind of something that I want to do. Like, I don't want to go to school for anything else. So I went to school in Charlotte. After we moved to North Carolina, we moved to the Raleigh-Durham area. My dad wasn't working in pharmaceuticals and my mom was working at a Duke hospital. So, So after high school, I moved to Charlotte to go to Johnson and Wales, to their Charlotte campus. The Charlotte campus was opened once they closed their campus in South Carolina and Virginia. So Charlotte was like the middle point.
Okay.
So went to Johnson and Wales, studied culinary arts and food service management. Went for a 4-year program, stayed in Charlotte for about like 2 years. I got my first fine dining job sophomore year of university.
Oh, okay. So you didn't like, you've always worked in fine dining then was going to be one of my questions.
Oh, well, so in high school, I had worked at like a burger and pizza shop. So that was like my first like real job. Mm-hmm. I started off as actually working the register. And then I was like, you know what? I don't really like interacting with like guests so much. Is there a way for me to like be in the kitchen? And they're like, well, the kitchen's kind of full, but like we're looking for like a busser or dishwasher. So I started off bussing tables and washing dishes. Then finally they started me off doing some prep in the kitchen. Then next thing I know, I was working pizza. I was working grill. I started there, I want to say when I was 16. So yeah, like junior year of high school.
Yeah.
Then worked junior year, senior year, and even like graduated like working there because that was like my main high school job. Mm. But I kind of want to say that like it was a lot of fun because we were just like a bunch of high school kids making pizzas and at the end of the day. But that also like made me realize, you know what, like I don't want to do anything else. Like I love cooking and I love having food. So like when I was looking for schools to attend, like I was looking, like I applied to Johnson and Wales and the CIA, which is the Culinary Institute of America in New York.
Yeah.
And then I also applied to like some regular hospitality programs at like UNC Greensboro and UNC Charlotte. I actually got into every school that I applied to. So just had to like figure out where I wanted to go. I didn't want to go to New York because I don't like the cold. So I chose to go to Johnson and Wales.
Yeah.
Which also wasn't like too far from home. So like Charlotte's only like a 3-hour drive. So like I could drive home when I wanted to. So started school. That was an interesting experience. I didn't really have to go to culinary school. I just went because like my parents said, you need a degree in something.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, why not go to culinary school? So, it was like the academic side was like really easy because academics are easy for me, but like the cooking part was also like pretty easy. Like like I was really just learning like the like terminology mm-hmm. of like the classical French cuisine, because that's so basically that's like how they start you off in the culinary world is classical French, your like European, Italian. So like I knew how to like cut things. I knew how to like hold a knife and like actually like cook. So I was just like learning like, oh, a very small dice is called a brunoise, a medium dice is called a like batonné, you know, just like French terms.
Those are all French yeah. to me.
But whilst I was there, like I knew that like I wanted to check out some of the restaurants too.
Okay.
So one of my classmates, he was working at one of the top seafood fine dining restaurants in Charlotte called Upstream Seafood. It specialized in like Asian style flavors, but with like seafood. So there was like a sushi bar, there's like an oyster bar, but like we did all types of seafood. But he was there as a busser also, and he was trying to get into the kitchen. So he was like, hey, there's a position as a busser, which is kind of strange. Like, it's always a busser position that's opening up now that I think about it.
That was always sort of your foot in the door to a kitchen.
Yeah. So I was a busser, like serving water and bread and like just doing that. And then finally, I told him, like, hey, like, my goal eventually is to get into the kitchen. Like, this is cool and all, but like, yeah. I'm a cook. Like, I want to cook. So they said that, well, how about we have you expo, because then you can see like the food going out. And I was like, all right, that's cool. I've never like done that before. So like, I learned how to like call out the tickets and pretty much like
how the kitchen runs essentially.
Yeah. But like, it was really like fun, because like I'm the one guiding service, like, hey, like take this to this table, take that to that table. All right, like cold slide, like are we ready to like are we ready on the salads that are going with the entrees? Like that was truly a fun experience. So once I was done with that, finally a prep a morning prep position opened. So they're like, well, now that you have seen what the final plates look like, now you can see how things are prepped, how they're started. So I prepped, then they finally moved me onto the line. And I was there for about 4 years.
Oh, okay. Was this while you were still in school?
Okay. Yeah. So I was there sophomore year of college, and when I left, I was already like finished with school.
Okay.
So when I left, I was pretty much like lead line cook and the pastry chef. Not really like the pastry chef, but I was in charge of doing the pastries.
Okay.
So in 4 years, I pretty much had worked every position in that kitchen. So then I was like, all right, I think it's time for me to move on and see like what else is in Charlotte for me.
Yeah.
So after finishing there and after graduating, I bounced around to several other restaurants. One of them was, I mean, the food scene in Charlotte is, you know, mostly all like Southern style food. So I specialize in a lot of that. But after that, I went to a couple like burger spots where I was like sous chef, pastry chef. I always ended up like being like a sous chef and like pastry chef. Like I always did pastry and savory, which is funny because in culinary school, like, I never really liked pastry because, like, it's like that, like, science of, like, oh, this has to be weighed, this has to be measured, or it's going to, like, mess everything up.
Right.
Whereas with cooking, you just throw it all together in a pot, and somehow it ends up good. But I was in Charlotte for about 10 years before I finally said, you know what, I don't really think I'm going anywhere, because, like, I was never really getting too many, like, management positions. Like, people were just trying to keep me as a cook, and I'm like, okay, I mean, I can cook, but there's more that, like, I want to do. Like, I want to, like, be a sous chef. Like, I want to be, like, a chef de cuisine. But, like, I wasn't getting those positions. So that led me to, like, that's, like, so that's kind of, like, how I got started with a Black Chef dinner series called So Food Sessions.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about that and why it was important to have it just be, like, Black chefs in particular.
Yeah, so Greg Collier was the chef who started that. He was a chef in South Carolina. He was actually looking for, like, a breakfast cook. So I reached out to him, like, hey, like, I saw you're looking for a cook. Like, let's meet. But, like, during this interview, we got talking about, like, being Black chefs and how, like we don't see us and, like, we're not getting those opportunities. So, like, after telling him, like, what's been happening, like, he was like, well, it's because you're Black, and, like, people don't know how to work with us, people don't know how to interact with us. So he was telling me that he was going to start this dinner series that was, like, something for us, by us, because, like, we didn't see ourselves, and all the other chefs who were doing dinners were, like, white chefs, and they weren't, like, trying to include any other chefs of color. So Greg and some of his other chef friends, it was Jamie Barnes, Jamie Turner, Greg Williams, and Greg's wife, Sabrina, and then also Michael Bowling. Those are the founding chefs. They had one dinner, and Chef Greg was like, hey, like, do you want to, like, just come and, like, hang out with us? And I was like, hell yeah. So I just, like, helped them cook and helped them plate, and just, like, the pure Blackness. It's just, like, this is what I've been missing in every kitchen, you know, like, that, like there's just something about, like, when Black people, when we come together, it's just, like, family, you know, like,
yeah,
like, it doesn't matter if you've never met each other, like, before, like, you hang out and we just, like, click.
So then I'm curious, like, you had that, like, it sounds like your career was growing to an extent. You've created this community of, you know, with other Black chefs, that all of this happening still in North Carolina, right? So how did you end up in the Bay Area, moving all the way across the country, when it sounded like you had a good thing going?
I mean, I always wanted to live in California, but, like, I just, yeah, like, I never really knew how to make that happen. And also, Charlotte, the food scene, like, it didn't have that fine dining scene that I was looking for, like with, like, Tweezers and Michelin and all that. Like, there was fine dining, but not to, like, the super higher end fine dining. So, like, the more kitchens that I had, like, worked in, like, I realized, hey, I want to do more fine dining. I did these dinners with all these chefs, but I still wasn't really getting any, like, real good jobs. So I was like, okay, maybe Charlotte isn't the move. Maybe it's finally time for me to, like, go to California, see what the food scene is about. I knew that I even wanted to do Chicago, New York, or California, but again, I don't like the cold weather. So I was like, California, here I come. So after doing several more dinners with, like, Greg and all of them, like, that actually gave me the confidence, like, to be like, hey, like, I'm just as good as any other chef in California. Like, let me go see what I can learn. Let me go see what that's about.
Did you just pack up and leave?
So I took a trip for 2 weeks to like stage around different kitchens, see like what the vibe was, see what housing was like, and just like experience San Francisco, because I'd never been to California, but like you see it on TV and it's like, all right, sunshine, why not? So I staged around. I actually got some offers. One of them was at SPQR, which was a one Michelin star restaurant. They actually ended up losing their Michelin star this year. And then I got another job offer from another restaurant in Palo Alto called Bird Dog. So I explained that I still live in California, but yeah. That I still lived in North Carolina, but I was going to be moving here in like January. So they're like, all right, we'll hold your position. I was like kind of working for restaurants, kind of wasn't, so I wasn't really like tied down to anyone. So like I packed up all my stuff. My parents helped me hire a shipping company for all like my large stuff. And then I put the rest of it in my car and I drove across the country.
That sounds like a story for some movie down the road. Like, what? All right. So you end up in California,
yes,
working, I guess, for, and I don't know if it's for one at a time or both, mixed up. But then at some point you decide to start to host, because I'm curious how you go from like working in the Southern kitchens, doing all of that, rising up, and then working with the Black, the Soul Food Sessions. And then in California, you start to host a series of pop-ups, and that's sort of what I want to talk about, in terms, especially because these sort of tie back then to your Ghanaian roots. And so I'm trying to connect the dots of how and where that sort of clicked for you, and that like you wanted to do this work, I guess. Starting with the pop-up, let's start with the pop-up. I know it used to be called Sankofa and then you changed the name too, right?
Yeah. So, you know, working in these kitchens, like I moved to San Francisco because like everyone kept saying, you know, it's progressive, you know, it's there's a lot of diversity. So I was like, all right, let's see. But like, I still wasn't seeing anyone that looked like me in these kitchens. I think when I started working in San Francisco, I worked at Murad, and that was the most Black people I'd ever seen in a Michelin fine dining kitchen. And like, but it wasn't the same like community that I felt with Soul Food Sessions. So that kind of made me like, all right, well, I've had this small experience with this series in Charlotte, like maybe I should try and do my own. So because I wasn't seeing what I wanted, I decided to create it in my own way. So I started, my first pop-up was like some cooks at SPQR. And then because pop-ups are very hard, I did it on and off because I still had to like work my full-time jobs. But that pop-up was like for something that was like chefs of color, primarily Black chefs. But I also, as I was learning more fine dining techniques and seeing more like African chefs and Black chefs pop up in the media, I was like, okay, maybe now I can start like tinkering with food that I grew up eating. Cause like, I never really wanted to do food from Ghana when I realized that I wanted to be a chef, because like the, or food in restaurants, you don't see it in fine dining, like there wasn't a lot of like value. But my parents were always telling me like, you have to cook African food. You have to cook food from Ghana, you know, no one's doing that. But like, I didn't believe them. I didn't think that like it would, like, I didn't think that it could be a thing. But like, as I got older and as I started to see it more, I was like, okay, you know, French food is boring. Italian food's boring. Like, everyone else is already doing that. Like, you know, even in like fine dining scene, like, it's still all the same stuff. So after like talking to my mom and just like calling her and like getting some recipes so I can like write them down, you know, I started like tinkering with like suya and jollof rice. And I started following chefs like Eric Hajapong and Zoe Hajonia and Selassie Hatadika. And I was seeing like the stuff that they were doing. And I'm like, oh shit, like that's, that's solid. Like, all right, we're like, there is a space for us. Like, it may not have been like as big as it is now, but I was starting to see like, okay, there are chefs out there doing it. So that's when I started Sankofa, which, you know, means to go back to your roots, to move forward.
Yeah, so essentially going back to his back to history, figuring out like what was good that you could then take and move forward with you in some ways. So
that inspired me to like look into all of the food that I had grown up eating, and I was like, all right, how can I put a fine dining spin on this? Because I had learned that like fine dining in Michelin is really easy. Like, it's not like cooking with like fire, I was going in the South, there's a lot of like sous vides and like hydrocolloids to do like the consistency. So I like realized, all right, this isn't the type of food that I necessarily want to do. Like, I still cook things from like scratch. Like, I don't really like to simmer things in a bag. It's just weird to me. It's weird. It's weird. But that made me start to like that made me start to look back more into my food. But then talking to my parents, you know, I'm an Ewe and Sankofa is an Hakan term.
Yeah.
So like doing more research into like my culture, and I was like, okay, well, I still want to tie it in. So like, I'm still, you know, going back to my roots, but I want to tie it into like the Ewe culture. So my dad was like talking to like my aunts and uncles and like Ghana and saying, you know, Selassie wants to start this pop-up, this restaurant, like, let's help her come up with some names. So my dad came up with like this long list of names for me to like try and pick, and I was like, all right, this is cool. So then I settled on Pilate, which is tasty in Ewe, or it appeals to the tongue, as my dad told me the translation. So Sankofa pop-up changed to Pilate
Test Kitchen.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, all right. I think now is probably a good time to take a quick break, and then when we come back, want to dive more into like what you did with Pilate Test Kitchen in terms of some of the creations that you had, and then transition into what you've done with another forum for Black chefs. And then we'll wrap up with sort of some of your specific experiences. I want to get your thoughts on fine dining in general, and then we'll do a rapid fire question. So we'll take a quick break and we will be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, The tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush, green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
So before we left off, we were talking about the new test kitchen, changing to Ewe just to realign with like specifically your specific Ghanaian roots. And then I just wanted to talk about some of the things, I guess, some of the creations that you made as part of those dinner series so that people get a sense of like how you're experimenting with specific Ghanaian taste and flavors. So I remember reading something like, which the Ghanaians here might, because I had a reaction to scallops in palm nut soup. So that was one of the ones that I thought that's interesting. curious to hear like your thoughts on some of the more interesting things you've done as part of the Test Kitchen series and like your thought process behind some of those takes, those creative takes.
Yeah, definitely. I did a dinner at my former job, and some of the dishes was a stuffed chicken wing. So, but it's a jollof stuffed chicken wing. I worked
a jollof with stuffed chicken wing.
Yeah, so I worked with a chef who did a stuffed chicken wing because I think it's a popular dish in Japanese culture. It's to stuff a chicken wing with rice and like fry it. So I was like, that's really cool. What if I took a chicken wing, stuffed it with jollof rice, and then I tossed it in like a shito honey chili glaze?
Oh, man.
So that was something that was like a hit at my pop-up.
I mean, I'm just listening to it and that sounds like to die for.
Oh, yeah. It was like, when I tasted it, I was like, all right, this is something. But like, everyone was like, yo, that was my favorite out of like the whole dish. Yeah, and I was like, oh,
that
wow.
That sounds amazing.
So my scallop and palm nut sauce dish, that was just a play on palm nut soup.
Mm-hmm.
Grew up eating that with like fufu and akla and banku. But I was like, all right, what's a more refined way of like presenting this? So my chef had a scallop dish. I would see how he would like prepare the scallops, but I was like, all right, I'm gonna do a different sauce for this. So it's like a base of the palm nut, but it's like coconut milk instead of like stock. And then I served it with a charred okra. So it was kind of like a play on like palm nut and like okra soup, but like seafood.
I'm curious if you've done okra soup, like with the draw and what people's reaction has been to that. If you have
not yet. I want to though, because you know, a lot of people don't like okra because of its thickness and the viscosity, but like me, like that's what I grew up eating.
Yeah,
like, that's,
I love
that's
it
normal.
Too.
like
I think, yeah. And that's interesting because I'm also aware, and so like that's what I grew up eating like from when I was two probably. So
yeah,
it's not been strange to me from that perspective. But I'm always curious, like people's like really strong reactions to this, what they call slimy or the draw or whatever. But it's, I'm like, you're missing out on some really good food.
Yeah, they really are. I mean, I think the ways that I try to like make okra a little bit more appealing is like the thing is with okra, the more you cut it, that's what brings out the slime. But if you cut it less, you know, it's not as slimy. But also my chef showed me a technique to cook okra where like you blanch it and shock it whole, and then that like draws out some of the slime. So like when you cut it and like sear it, it's not like super slimy. It's still kind of like crisp and like crunchy, but just has like a little bit of that like slime. So that's what I did so that I could still add okra to the dish, but not have it be like this super viscous, thick soup.
No, that sounds good. I look forward to seeing it on a menu that you have sometime soon. So is that an ongoing series now? Like, where do you host it if people were interested? Like, what's the story around how that's set up?
So I kind of had to take a break from doing it full time. Okay. I do it like here and there. Like, I was just doing a chocolate dinner where I was able to represent High Felicia, but I was also able to represent Pilate. Mm-hmm. So if I get invited to do events, that's normally when I'll like say, hey, I'm doing a pop-up. I would like to get into doing it like once a month, maybe. Okay. Just to like keep it going. But I'm still waiting to find like a solid location so that like I don't have to do it at a different spot, you know, each month.
Right. And then I also wanted to touch on like a hard pill to swallow. One.
Yes.
I was like, that's a mouthful. Tell us why it's called that. And then like what the story is behind like what you're trying to do there also.
So a hard pill to swallow. It's a dinner series that's pretty much based off of Soul Food Sessions. It's something that's for Black people in hospitality. So chefs, somms, mixologists, restaurateurs. But it's also going to talk about like how hospitality is rooted in racism and how Black people have had to rise from that. So because a lot of people don't like to talk about race, a lot of people don't like to talk about slavery, that's how I was like, okay, this is going to be, it's a hard pill to swallow, mm-hmm. you know? So that's how I came up with that name.
Okay.
The idea was, you know, doing Soul Food Sessions and just having that sense of like family and community with Black chefs and Black somms, like, I wasn't seeing that in a city that calls itself progressive. So I was like, all right, I'm going to start my own series. If you guys aren't going to include us in your pop-ups or your dinner series, then I want to start my own. You know, like, I'm going to start it and I'm going to talk about the issues that no one really wants to talk about, you know, like hospitality is rooted in slavery. There's a lot of reasons why hospitality is the way that it is. You know, there's a lot of reasons why it's rooted in all of the isms of like sexism and racism.
Yeah.
Ageism, like, it's because it's rooted in slavery. And when you have the Black people who were doing everything, like, it's not surprised that like it still has that history. It's still like, hey, like, the reason why we don't have like benefits and like health insurance in hospitality is because the enslaved folks, they were just supposed to cook for people. Like, they weren't supposed to like be able to take care of themselves or take care of their families. Like, they were just seen as like labor, and that's kind of led to like how things are shaped now. So yeah, that's how I that's how I came to start that series.
And then when you think about that's like, that's great, as you were talking, it made me think about just hospitality and maybe specifically fine dining on a broader scale, like globally, just because with Noma closing down, there's been a lot of conversation about the fine dining business model and like why it wasn't sustainable, even for a place like Noma that's charging, I don't even know, 500, 600 euros per plate. or per experience. Like, I don't even remember what the exact pricing is, but like, if a place like that can't survive, you know, then it's clear that there's something wrong with the business model. And that it probably ties to what you're saying now, about the roots of that. And wanted to then touch on, like, you wrote a very eye-opening article for each of San Francisco about anti-blackness in fine dining in the Bay Area. And I mean, reading it, it's just like my heart went out to you. Like, I can't imagine working in, well, I can, but not in the context that you're like, a lot of us work in spaces where we are the onlys, right?
Yes.
So not necessarily in the kitchen alone, but just in corporate spaces and like in, you know, different other spaces. So I could relate to an extent to what you were talking about, and especially that intersection of identities, like where you're both Black and African. Like, I don't have, like, I didn't grow up here, but
right.
Just in the corporate spaces that I work in, people assume that I'm like, I'm American Black. And so I experienced that to an extent where I have to explain that I'm not, and I don't, there's a tension there where I don't, yeah, that's a whole conversation for another day. But for your experience specifically in the kitchen, where you're grappling with being like Black as in Black American, but also being like an African in those spaces and those identities, like, just maybe just sharing one, giving people some context who've not read the article. I will share a link to the article in the show notes so people can read in full. But just a couple of examples, just so people can get a sense of like how challenging that can be. And then your thoughts, the, you know, like your high level thoughts from what you shared in the article about what that means.
Being Black in a primarily white space, you know, that. I think coming from the South, you know, where like the racism is like in your face, like being in the Bay, it was a bit more like subtle. So like I wrote that article mostly because, like, you know, after George Floyd, like a bunch of restaurants were posting in solidarity of like Black lives. And I was like, but there are no Black people in your spaces. So how are you posting in solidarity when you guys are part of the part of that problem, you know? And then when you do have Black people, you know, we're not centered, you know, like we're just there. We're usually like tokenized. I just got tired of like the weird comments, the weird questions, you know, like being Black, you know, there's a certain way that we speak. There are certain things that we say that are just like us. And then like working with some of these chefs, like they would just like laugh at things or just would like make weird comments. Being African, I was like saying something and one of my chefs was like, you should say that in an African accent. And I'm just kind of like, why is it okay to say that? Like, you know, it's just, how can I word this? it's a lot, you know. I really just got frustrated at the end of the day. That's what really just happened. I got frustrated and I was like, you guys aren't doing anything. You guys are part of the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, someone needs to say something. Someone needs to speak up, because like when you are usually the token, you don't feel like you can speak up because no one really there has your back. So, I mean, I wasn't necessarily trying to speak up for like all Black people mm-hmm. in fine dining. I was just saying like, hey, like these have been my experiences. I'm sure there are other chefs and somms and mixologists who have felt similar, but like they don't feel like they have that voice.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of us don't feel like no one's really like looking out for us. You know, you walk into a kitchen, you're like, all right, I see. And it's like, damn, like no one here looks like me. So no one's really going to like get like, hey, what you said, that's not funny. Like, you don't always have to like use hip hop to like try and have a conversation with me. Like we're chefs. Let's talk about food. Like, we don't have to talk about Black culture, you know, like try and find ways to, I guess, just make Black people feel not like we are the other, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so you eventually transitioned to, and you're now working at High Felicia, which is a Black-owned, if I remember correctly, a Black-owned fine dining restaurant?
Yes, Black-owned fine dining in downtown, multi-course tasting menu. It started off as a pop-up on the owner's patio. Yeah, so like she also works in fine dining and was fed up due to the racism in fine dining. So she was like, I'm going to start my own space. So she started a pop-up. Then she was able to secure a brick and mortar in April of last year. I joined in July, and I was supposed to be a sous chef, but her CDC left, and then she asked me to take that position, and I was like, you know, you're the first person to offer me a CDC position, so yes, I will take it.
And for those who are not kitchen folks, chef de cuisine is what
CDC stands for. Yes.
Awesome. Great. And so in terms of like what's next for you in the food space, I feel like you've sort of landed in a great space with High Felicia. What's next for you? When you think about your career in food, when you're looking down the horizon, like it sounds like you want to do more with Eladi.
Yes.
But if you think about the next year, the next 5 years, like what are you thinking in terms of how you want to maybe develop your own skills, but then also grow your own like brand and maybe also telling that, you know, African food story through Eladi and other means?
So I'm definitely know that going to Ghana is in the future.
Oh, okay.
It's been 20 years since I've been back to Ghana. The last time I went, when I was 13. And I'm now 33, so it's a long time coming. Ghana is in the future, just so that I can like cook with my aunts and my grandmas and like really like dive into the food. Like I want to be able to cook with our ingredients, you know. Yeah. I've got the spices, but like I want to be able to like cook with like yam when it's in season. I want to be able to cook with like garden eggs. I want to be able to cook with like rice from Ghana, you know. Like I want to get my hands into the culture as much as I can. I don't know how long I want to be in Ghana for, but I'm probably planning to go to Ghana sometime this year. And then I eventually want to open up my own restaurant. I don't know if it'll be in the next 5 years. Hopefully, though.
Speak it into existence. You never know. Like someone shared with me a vision board that I did 5 years. Was it five? Maybe 4 years ago?
Wow.
That I'd completely forgotten about. And one of the things I had mentioned was like wanting to have a restaurant. So a restaurant in Ghana at some point, and literally I thought this was like 10, 15 years down the road. And I recently just opened one, but it's just the story is maybe for another podcast, but it just was a combination of circumstance, opportunity, luck, like all sorts of things that happened to make that come true. So I'm a big believer in, you know, speaking a vision, putting it, writing it down, what have you. And if you're working intentionally towards it, I feel like it would come true. So I wouldn't dismiss it. You never know. You never know who could be listening and being like, hey, I'm going to reach out to Selassie. And so
I mean, that is the end goal, but I want to be able to do it right. Like that's why I'm taking my time with having a restaurant, because I want to be able to give benefits. I want to be able to.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. There's more than just like the cooking part. I want to be able to like take care of my employees. So.
Yeah. That's the right way to do it. Awesome. So before we transition to rapid fire, can you let people know where they can find you online, social media, what have you?
Yeah. I'm on Instagram and Facebook. My Facebook is Selassie Doce. I have a page for Helade Test Kitchen on Facebook. You can also find me on Instagram with the name Selassie Doce. A Hard Pill to Swallow is also on Instagram, and so is Helade Test Kitchen. I have a Twitter, but I'm on Instagram a lot more.
Okay, so I will share those links then, so people can follow you too. Know about more about your story, and then if they're in the area, check you out at Hi Felicia. Cool. So very quickly, rapid fire questions. The first one is, what's one ingredient you cannot live without?
Suya?
Okay.
Suya.
and then would you rather lose your sense of smell or taste?
I would probably say smell.
Smell. Okay. And then what is your favorite? Although I feel like we've answered this question, that it's definitely not winter, but what is your favorite season?
Probably summer.
And then lastly, who would you rather meet, your ancestors or your future descendants?
That's a good question. Let's go with our ancestors.
Okay. I'm curious why, because I feel like everybody says ancestors.
Oh yeah?
Everybody says ancestors, actually.
I mean, just mostly because to like pick their brain and figure out like all of the knowledge that they have to talk about their experiences, you know, just to connect. Yeah.
Interesting. I feel like and I guess I've never answered this on the show, but I feel like I would want to meet like my future descendants just to see
where the story goes,
right? Like, especially like in African food, like all of the work that different people are doing, like I don't know, 50 years from now, is African food mainstream? Like do people understand the different, like what
I may change my answer now actually.
No, what do people don't understand yet that I could potentially change in how I'm shaping the narrative? Like I feel like that's what I would want to know. But everybody wants to meet the ancestors, which is always interesting to me. But now I've shared my answers to everybody. I hope that doesn't change people's answer in the future. But yes. So, well, thank you, Selassie, for the time today. It was so nice to chat with you, learn about your experience. Some unfortunate, but it's glad to see. I'm happy to see that like you've worked through a lot of that. It sounds like you're in a really good place now. And I especially am looking forward to seeing your take on okra soup. and hoping to try that someday. So thank you.
Item 13 is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.